This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
New research reveals that over half of those aged over 50 years old believe the midlife crisis is now a thing of the past, with one in three now experiencing a three-quarter life crisis. As the average life expectancy in Australia continues to increase, people are starting families later, retiring later, and perusing pastimes later in life. Here's Professor of Psychology, Dr. Nick Haslam from the University of Melbourne, talking about the research.
So you've done some research about the attitudes of older Australians toward ageing. What did you find out?
Well, this survey, which is commissioned by Australian Seniors, was looking at a lot of things, including, as you say, attitudes towards ageing. And I think in terms of attitudes towards ageing, most of these 5,000 seniors, people over 50 who were surveyed, really felt that the culture doesn't see them the way they see themselves. So often I think older Australians think that they're seen as being not very tech-savvy, being a bit intolerant, not able to learn new things, a bit unproductive, whereas they tend to see themselves as having more wisdom and maturity.
Mm. So it's kind of an interesting comment because we're starting to see like some sort of battle between different age groups with things like, you know, okay boomer, where, you know, people are dismissing attitudes of people who are over 50 because they feel like they aren't relevant.
Yeah, look, and I think there's a lot of suspicion and hostility going in all directions here, and probably younger Australians tend to think that older Australians have some distorted views of them as well. And now, that wasn't the focus of this research, but I think you're spot on. There's a lot of generational misunderstanding and angst, and some of it's maybe got some kind of basis in economic reality. It is a hard time to be young if you want to break into the property market, but it's also a hard time, I think, if you're unemployed in your 50s and trying to get back into the workforce. So I think there's challenges all around.
Yeah, and I would have to say that age discrimination is sort of the more insidious one because, it, you know, in an article I read last week, it's not necessarily that the applicant is too old, it's that they're, you know, not a good fit for the culture, and that's why they are being, that's what they're being told and not hired.
Yeah, and that doesn't fit with the culture is a very, very weaselly kind of comment, really, because it can contain a massive multitude of discriminations and stereotypes. And I think to the extent that it's based on a view that older people are actually just not as adaptable, that certainly doesn't correspond to how the people surveyed in our survey thought.
So if we can get into some kind of numbers here. A lot of people in your survey didn't think that the midlife crisis was a thing. And that idea, I think, started out in the late 60s as sort of like a 35 to 45 thing, but now is really seen a lot more as sort of 45 to 55. But your respondents said that they didn't think that that was as big of an event as it used to be.
Yeah, you got that spot on. Look, I think the idea of a midlife crisis, as you say, has been around since about the 60s, but it's always been a little bit vague when it was meant to happen. So I guess if it really was midlife back in the 60s, people were living to about 70 on average, so probably it would have been about 35. But really, what we find if you do research on the midlife crisis is that people in their 30s think they're having one, and people in their 40s think they're having one, and people in their 50s think they're having one. It's very vague about where it actually occurs. And in fact, there's no real strong evidence that any particular decade of life is more likely to have crises than others. There are just crises that happen in midlife rather than a midlife crisis. And certainly the 50-plus adults that were surveyed in this 100-year lifespan report, they didn't really recall in most cases having had a midlife crisis themselves. And what was more real to them and what one-third of them admitted to having experienced themselves and about one-half had witnessed in other people they knew was what we're calling the three-quarter life crisis, which is, again, without putting a specific age on it, more towards 60 perhaps, where people are sort of reassessing their priorities, thinking about how they might want to live the decades they have left, and really just evaluating where they're going.
Well,
so it's not so much, if you just, sorry to interrupt, it's not so much, you know, buying the red sports car and getting the inappropriately younger mate and wearing the leather pants and all that kind of thing. It's more it's more the you know, healthy reevaluation of one's future.
Well, it actually ties in with the sort of pop culture thing about the Saturn return, and what the Saturn return is that Saturn returns to the same place in the sky when you're about 28 to 30, and that marks a big change from early adulthood into, you know, this is going to be my career, and that happens in a lot of people. You often, it seems like people don't realize it till they're out of it, but I went through a situation like that, and a number of my friends have, and then people tend to have a second one, and that's about 30 years later, and that's also a time of huge change. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, it lines up with that period. You know, you don't have to believe in astrology, but if you listen to the people around you, you might hear stories about those times being really influential.
Yes, and it makes sense. And however you theorize it, I think it was certainly resonating with the people in the survey. And it makes sense for all sorts of reasons. I think, you know, work is something that matters to a lot of people. A lot of people find it an important part of their identity. And you know, whether or not they find it important to their identity, they depend on it financially. And if you can look forward a small number of years to your work life ending, I think that's, of course, going to be a time of reconsideration. You know, a crisis doesn't mean necessarily a time of deep despair and unhappiness, although I'm sure in some cases it is. It's more just a turning point or transition.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things about the survey was how many of the older Australians really didn't like the word or the idea of retirement, this idea that all of a sudden, you know, at age 65, you magically go from being fully employed to fully unemployed and a bit past it. They saw it much more as a gradual transition. A lot more of them thought that there'd be some period of part-time work or casual work or going back and doing some other line of work.
Yeah.
Maybe not full-time. They still thought that 65 to 69 was about the right time to cease full-time work. But getting back to your original point, I think if you're at that stage of life where the traditional retirement age isn't that far in your future, it does make sense to think about that future.
Of course. People were, in your survey, were talking about whether or not they felt like they were prepared for these changes in their life as they got older. What can you tell me about that?
I think people felt they varied a lot. I mean, there's huge variations, and I think one of the strengths of the survey is that it really was nationally representative. People of all genders, people of all wealth backgrounds, all states, territories. And they varied in how prepared they felt, and I think a lot of them really found it very important to be self-funded in their retirement, and I'm sure a very large number weren't as well prepared as they would want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was more important to many of them was a sense that the world around them or the society around them wasn't quite as prepared as it should be. They were certainly quite concerned about whether there'd be sufficient aged care facilities and health care facilities. They had real concerns about whether there was enough provision of these sorts of services for older people. Because, you know, the lifespan is getting longer and longer, and our survey participants thought that 92 was a pretty good innings to aim for. Life expectancy is more 84 or so these days. But that's a long time to be living. And, of course, we can expect, no matter how good medicine gets, that there will be some decline physically and maybe psychologically as well. And there were concerns about preparation for that. But I think, on average, most of our participants were really quite optimistic about the future. They didn't feel drastically underprepared. They really looked forward to developing new pastimes, new interests, spending more time with family, traveling, ticking things off that bucket list, and so on.
And where this cohort wants to live is largely in apartments, is that correct?
I don't think largely, but I think about a quarter of people were open to this idea of what we called in the survey a sea change from letter C, meaning to city. So I think there was greater openness to that sort of idea. Most people still wanted to be in sort of freestanding homes, I think, on average. So it wasn't a majority, but I think the idea of being in a metropolitan area was important to lots of them. And if there was going to be a move, it was a move towards cities rather than away from cities.
And the lowest number in your survey wanted to live in retirement homes, is that correct?
Yes, that's not very popular, and I think, at least among the people we looked at. Now, I think, again, that's something that might vary within the age range we looked at. So we were looking at people 50 and above, and maybe the attractiveness of that does change as you get older, but it was not a popular source. People want to be living independently in their own space for as long as possible.
Yeah, definitely. What should Australians as a country be doing to help our older population?
Well, I think it does need to invest in aged care facilities and make sure that provision for older Australians is keeping up with the fact that they are living longer and more active lives. And again, this is going to sound a little bit sort of vague, but I think also just showing older people that they're valued, sure that age discrimination is not tolerated, making sure there's a voice for older people, that in our fairly youth-obsessed culture, the full age range is important and that everyone needs to be respected and represented. I think easier said than done. I think anything that can be done to sort of protect retirement savings and ensure that financial security is available to all, those who have spent a whole life contributing tax income to the public purse should expect to be sort of well looked after. Again, fairly vague prescriptions, but I think a lot of it comes down to just respecting the dignity of older people and respecting the value of their voices.
Talking about societal roles, what sort of activities do work really well to incorporate people in this cohort?
That's a really good question. Look, I think first it does need to be said that not everyone wants to be incorporated. I think, belonging in the abstract is really good, but a lot of people really want time to be peaceful, to have time with family rather than to go broader than that. Look, I'm in the education sector, and I think going back to study and University of the Third Age and things like that are great initiatives. Getting people involved in shared tasks, I think, interest groups and sort of exercise-based groups and sort of special classes for people at pools or gyms are really good sorts of activities, and they also, of course, contribute to better health. I think what we're finding in psychology more and more is that social connections are incredibly important. They're not just the icing on the cake, they're actually the cake itself. And anything that can be done to sort of pull people out of isolation, unless they want to be isolated, is going to be a good thing. So, clubs, societies, these sorts of things, anything that, that brings people together in ways that make them feel valued and wanted.
You know, two of the things that really resonate with our audience at Joy is inclusion as an LGBTIQA plus person. We're starting to see healthcare facilities like LifeView and Epworth Hospital are getting or have received rainbow ticks. So, they're aware of, the need to serve different communities well. And there's also the socially isolated for whatever reason. Like, how do you engage these populations?
I think it's a really good question. I think there are no simple answers, and but I think one important thing is just signaling inclusiveness and making it known and not keeping things silent. Having groups, having, as you said, sort of Rainbow Tick and other sort of initiatives which signal to groups that they are valued, they are included, they are welcome is crucial. And I think there's a real role for sort of community organizations as well, and I'm sure for radio stations. Any group that is getting the voice out there and is offering a point of contact and a point of dissemination of information, which brings people together, is obviously a good thing.
there's a real big thing about volunteering. When I started volunteering at Joy, I met so many lovely people from all parts of the rainbow spectrum, and really all ages. And they, you know, some of them have amazing stories to tell, and you know, lots of talent, and generally really friendly.
Yeah, look, I think you make a really important point about volunteering. It is so underestimated how much good that does people, not just to the people who are the recipients of all of that freely given labor, but also for the volunteers themselves. Volunteers tend to get a huge amount out of the experience. It's just like, you know, like anything, you know, often giving is better for the giver than the person who receives.
But not on radio. Even making available.
Yeah, making available. Well, I mean, in your case, you're doing a wonderful thing for others, but the fact that you're enjoying it as well is important. So I think you know, maybe that's another line of possibility. Having volunteering opportunities made publicly available is a chance for people who might be a little bit off put by the idea of sort of joining some group when they think they're just going to be, they're not sure how they'll get along, and they might worry about whether it's inclusive of them or whatever. They can actually make a positive contribution and see themselves not just as taking, but also giving.
And also, from my observations of volunteering for a few organizations, it's about setting up different roles for different people and finding what works for them and not making everyone stuff envelopes all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it can be done better and worse. And I think, you know, obviously, if groups rely on volunteers, they've got to be responsive to them and not treat them as just fodder.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to touch on?
No, I think you've really done a good job of covering it. You know, this 100-year lifespan report did cover lots of areas, but we talked about ageism, and we talked about what people wanted to do afterwards, and we talked about the three-quarter life crisis and the like, and I think it's, we've covered all of it.
I wanted to bring up about societal roles for older people. Mm-hmm. When I studied sociology of Japan, which was a unit I took in university, we found quite a number of issues reflected in the text about there were very traditional roles for, you know, children, parents, and grandparents, but because Japanese people started living quite a bit longer quite quickly, there was now a fourth generation who didn't have a defined role and often were either isolated, just sort of living in a room at the bottom of the house, because they didn't know what kind of role for them to do. And having a role, it was really important to them. And so it's sort of, you know, when we have societal roles here, it's about, I think, just even looking at your own family and, you know, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. And, you know, we sometimes forget there's so many bad things that happen in the world. We just forget the fact that there are some good things. And, you know, even comparing ourselves now to the 80s, people are living on average about 9 years longer in Australia. That's a lot of time, and it does create new roles, or at least new gaps between existing roles. And I think you've also got a generation coming through who've been at the forefront of lots of important social changes and who are not prepared to become, you know, dull, old, and boring, and want to sort of reinvent things and feel, you know, youthful inside themselves. Now, how can you be a youthful person in your 70s? Well, I think we're sort of trying to people are trying to sort of find ways of doing that. But the example you refer to in Japan, I don't know too much about, but you know, we've had a similar expansion of our lifespans, and I think finding new ways to age productively and creatively is really important.
That was Dr. Nick Haslam, Professor of Psychology from Melbourne University, speaking to Arian Potts. This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.